you hate government, one of them libertarian types, or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, y'all. Scott Horton Show. Archives at scotthorton.org and sign up for the podcast feed and follow me on Twitter at Scott Horton Show. Okay. Jason Leopold, man, he's a hell of a journalist. He writes for vice.com, news.vice.com. And, well, he's the foremost FOIA terrorist in our land, and I mean that in the very best way, and that is a big part of the reason why he is constantly breaking huge scoops. I mean, sometimes 3-4 in a week, and, you know, maybe more than that. I don't know. Can't keep track of them all. This one is called, "This is how the CIA's first captive after 9/11 described his years of torture." Welcome back to the show, Jason. How are you, sir?
Great to be back with you, Scott, and thank you for those for that very kind intro and the kind words. I appreciate it.
Yeah, well, you deserve it. And, of course, you're the guy more than anyone else who's covered the story, told the real story of Abu Zubaydah. Now, yes. I said he was important. You're not going to make me lose face on this, are you, George? I'm sorry, that was what President George W. Bush said to CIA Director George Tenet.
That's right, yeah. That was right after. That was around sometime in 2002. Mm-hmm. Obviously, a very short time after Abu Zubaydah was captured in Pakistan in March of 2002.
And it is true that Bush cited him over and over and over again to say, yeah, we had to torture people. We had guys like this guy Zubaydah, who, if we didn't torture him, he wasn't going to tell us all the stuff he knew. And boy, did he know a lot of stuff, because he was the number three leader of Al-Qaeda.
Right. He's the number three leader. He was involved in every major Al-Qaeda terrorist operation going back to the East African bombings. At one point, I believe even Donald Rumsfeld said he may have even been number two in Al-Qaeda. I mean, the Bush administration held Abu Zubaydah up as the, you know, top official, if you will, in that terrorist organization.
So what's the truth?
Well, the truth is that he wasn't. He wasn't even a member of Al-Qaeda, and he never swore bayat, you know, allegiance to Osama bin Laden, which is the formal procedure, if you will, in which one becomes a member of Al-Qaeda. He sort of rejected Al-Qaeda. Abu Zubaydah ran a training camp, that was attended by many of the Mujahideen who were fighting the Soviets, that the CIA obviously, you know, supported, in Afghanistan back in, the 80s and 90s. And, Abu Zubaydah was one of them. I mean, he was actually someone who was fighting, you know, the Soviets and then the communist, government, there. And, you know, this training camp was attended by or thousands of, the Mujahideen and later some jihadists attended that, training camp. But, he was sort of the facilitator there. So let me actually correct myself a bit. He didn't actually run it in the sense of, you know, he was the top guy there. He was in charge of many of the sort of programs that came out of there. The U.S. claimed that this was, you know, an Al-Qaeda training camp. It was not an Al-Qaeda training camp. In fact, Osama bin Laden tried to close down the training camp, because the emir, of that camp, Ibn, al-Sheikh al-Libi, who also died in, after being in CIA custody, when he was turned over to, the Libyans, he rejected that. And so, you know, that's sort of the inside story of of what was happening, or at least what was the truth.
But I mean, it sounds like what you're saying is you could see how maybe they would have thought, okay, well, here's an Arab, right? He's not an Afghan. Where is he from again?
He's from Saudi Arabia.
Saudi.
He's of Palestinian descent.
Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, I knew it was something complicated. But anyway, he ain't from there.
He was born and raised in Saudi Arabia.
He's running this training camp. And, so, you know, I don't know. Looks like he probably is buddies with Osama, but at what point should they have known better? I guess is what I'm trying to ask.
That's a great question, Scott. And even the point where you say he was buddies with Osama bin Laden, he makes a point, you know, in this story that you're talking about here that I put together last week. Let me just for a moment say that this is, you know, extraordinary in the sense that this is a declaration that Abu Zubaydah provided to his attorneys describing his torture. In this declaration, he said that in Afghanistan, everyone knew who Osama bin Laden was. It was no secret that if you were in a certain part of Afghanistan, you knew who Osama bin Laden was. In the same way that if you were, you know, in, say, New York City, in the Little Italy, you may know who John Gotti was. You may have bumped into him because, you know, you live in that area. The U.S. and the CIA in the summer of 2002, okay, that Abu Zubaydah was not the person that the Bush administration had claimed him to be. They knew very early on. They knew less than 6 months, Scott, after they captured him. But what the Bush administration did, what various officials there did, what the CIA did, is that they continued to hold him up as a top official in Al-Qaeda. They continued to claim that, that he was operational. Abu Zubaydah was not operational. He was not planning operations, in the way that other, suspected terrorists, from Al-Qaeda, were, that the U.S. Captured and placed into the interrogation, the torture program. Mm-hmm. So they knew very early on about that. And in fact, he goes into this amazing detail about what was being said to him, during the course of his interrogation about, yeah, we made a mistake. So the public was led to believe, and even to this day, Scott, journalists will continue to write about Abu Zubaydah and claim that he is, you know, a member of Al-Qaeda. He's a top terrorist. He wasn't, and he isn't.
Yeah. Well, they Googled it and they got a lot of results for that. So seems like the consensus.
Right. Yeah.
Well,
I mean, he has, if there is anyone who the U.S. has captured, post 9/11, I would say that the person who has the most fascinating story and why I have just been sort of obsessed with his story, or with the story, is Abu Zubaydah. The CIA, in their response to the Senate Intelligence Committee's torture report, they say that everything they learned about Al-Qaeda came from two people, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and Abu Zubaydah. Abu Zubaydah is in the 9/11 Commission report, you know, dozens of times. Abu Zubaydah's name appears in that infamous August 2001 presidential daily brief warning Bush that Osama bin Laden is determined to strike in the U.S. I mean, his name is everywhere. So he's a very, very interesting character. And, a few years ago, you and I have spoken about this. I obtained his diaries, mm-hmm. The first six volumes of his diaries that the U.S. Seized after he was captured. And it just provides extraordinary detail into the life of, this Mujahideen, Abu Zubaydah, and, just the mindset of a jihadist. But it also shows, you know, it's clear if you just take his, take him at his own words that, that the U.S. should have known very early on. And what's amazing, Scott, is that after they subjected him to every torture technique, he was the guinea pig for the CIA's torture program. They then sought to, keep secret everything that they did to him. They destroyed the interrogation torture videotapes, which led the Senate Intelligence Committee to launch its investigation. One of those one of those videotapes shows Abu Zubaydah being waterboarded. They blocked any attempt by Abu Zubaydah to discuss openly his own, you know, his own treatment, his torture. They in CIA cables that the Senate Intelligence Committee cited in their report, CIA officers said, we can never let Abu Zubaydah see the light of day. If he dies, we've got to cremate his body. We got to disappear him. I mean, this was a person that more, even more than, say, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed or any of the people that the U.S. says was behind 9/11 or planned the 9/11 attacks. It was Abu Zubaydah where they said, where intelligence officers said, we got to make sure that this person is never seen or heard from again.
Yeah. All right. Now, so remind me again, your opinion of the FBI narrative that, geez, we were giving him, you know, ice chips and cookies, and he was telling us everything he knew until the CIA came and kidnapped him away from us.
I'm not sure I completely believe that. And in fact, you know, again, another extraordinary detail in this declaration. This is a declaration that was under seal for 7 years. In 2009, his attorneys filed it. The government said it needs to be under seal. It was only unsealed 2 weeks ago. And in that declaration, Abu Zubaydah talks about when his torture first started. It first started after he was moved out of a hospital. He sustained gunshot wounds when the U.S. And Pakistani forces captured him, and his torture started with the FBI interrogation. And that interrogation by FBI agents consisted of subjecting Abu Zubaydah to sleep deprivation, various other types of torture. Through, you know, noise, sound machines that he talks about, isolation.
And this is before the CIA showed up?
Apparently so.
Mm-hmm.
Again, you know, I mean, it makes clear that, you know, his own memory because of what he was subjected to is not entirely reliable. But, you know, he describes this as torture, you know, being subjected to, sleep deprivation. Okay. He describes it as that. And I think others, you know, would agree that that would be consistent with, you know, the definition of torture. What he says, you know, what changed is when the CIA showed up and then started putting him in dog boxes, and other types of, you know, boxes in which he was, forced to, remain standing or sitting in a crouched position for hours. So, it was different types of techniques that were being used on him and prior to any, you know, written authorization by the Justice Department.
Hey, Al, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com.
Right. Which, of course, that written authorization wouldn't be enough to override the law anyway, but that is a very important point that they were doing this and got the permission slip after the fact, which, you know, if you have a system supposedly of law, that ought to count for something. But anyway, am I right? Do I remember right, Jason, that they didn't, once the CIA got a hold of them and they started putting them in these coffins, I mean, virtually burying them alive, if not outright dropping them in the ground there, but, Once they started doing that, am I right? They didn't even start questioning him again for like 3 months. They wanted to go ahead and do the full learned helplessness psychological break before they even started asking him questions again.
Yeah, I would say that that's correct to some extent. I mean, I don't know if it was 3 months, but it certainly was a period of time. And, you know, I landed an exclusive interview with the architect of this program, and he explained in methodical terms why, you know, the interrogations would take on that sort of, you know, why that procedure would follow, you know, to get them to become compliant. And by doing that, by following those guidelines, if you will, those sort of made up guidelines or what they put in place, you know, the detainee, the prisoner, the captive would become compliant. And in the case of Abu Zubaydah, it did. I mean, it worked. The interrogator would, you know, raise an eyebrow or snap his fingers, and Abu Zubaydah would know immediately that he needed to get onto the waterboarding table. So it's quite chilling, but
even then you could imagine that they could have gotten him to be that compliant with much less torture and deprivation and isolation and everything else. He knew that he had lost the battle the moment he was arrested. What's he going to do? Resist them defiantly forever?
Right. I mean, I think that is, right. I mean, no. And you know, what's important for me to point out as well is that while we have heard about, you know, the way in which Abu Zubaydah was tortured, the way what he was subjected to, the dozens of waterboarding sessions, we heard that. That's not new. Your listeners are going to say, we heard that before. What is new here, Scott? What stands out, what's different, is that we've never heard it from Abu Zubaydah. We've never had the opportunity to read, to hear how he described his own treatment. Why? Because that has been classified, top secret, for 14 years. We just never had this chance. This is that first opportunity that you get to hear directly from him in his own words.
Yeah. Well, and you know, I don't know, man. I wonder about, it is 2016, so audiences certainly change and come and go and this kind of thing. And I wonder how many people listening to this remember believing George W. Bush and remember even justifying torture based on the promise that, yeah, we're torturing some guys. Don't ever call it that. But yeah, we're torturing some guys, but only guys that really, really deserve it. You know, the ones that knocked our towers down. So screw them, right, everybody? And 150 million Americans said, yeah, hey, if that's what you say, Mr. President, we're with you on that. And yet it was a lie.
Yes, the guy, but look, Scott, I mean, this is a main argument right now by the presumptive Republican, you know, nominee, Donald Trump, saying that he said, you know, just last month, I like waterboarding a lot. I think we need to return to torture. These guys did this. You know, it's the same sort of commentary. You know, whether or not they're guilty or they deserve it. I mean, it this is the same type of rhetoric, that we heard immediately after 9/11 and that people rallied around behind, including members of Congress, mind you. You know, we're hearing it again, and people are okay with that. So,
well, and it's really in contrast to,
I mean, it's something that people do support. So,
right. But meanwhile, all they would have to do, if anybody wanted to try, and I mean, I'm not naive, but I could certainly, you know, easily imagine this argument that actually, no, because we're so exceptional in our wonderful Western civilization here, we don't torture people because that's something that barbarians do, not enlightened, wonderful, exceptional people like us. Even John Adams once said, geez, you shouldn't torture that guy or whatever it is, and just dress it all up in red, white, and blue and Americanism and look at how special we are because we're not torturers. That's all you got to do. And yet,
right.
No one has the courage to even try to do that.
No, I don't think that, you know, you have some people, you know, coming out and making comments or responding to that. But for some reason, you know, you see what we are, contending with after 9/11. We're still dealing with this. As I said, that this declaration from Abu Zubaydah, it's 7 years old, but it's still important to get out there.
Which, by the way, Hillary is on the record for torturing people in the mythical ticking time bomb scenario, which is the same thing that the Bush administration used as their excuse, too. So,
we're
clear on that.
And by the way, with Abu Zubaydah, that was one of the, assertions by, by the CIA that, this was a ticking time bomb scenario. He needed to give us, intelligence. And at least if you were to, take Abu Zubaydah's narrative, right, in this declaration, he's saying time and again that he didn't give them anything. He did not provide them with any intelligence. He kept saying that, you got the wrong, the wrong person, or I don't know about any of these operations. He does say in this declaration that, there came a time when he would just say, tell me what you want me to say. And other times he would just lie to give them what they wanted just to get the pain to stop. There is, I want to make it clear also that it's not entirely, to make it sound, when I say innocent, I don't mean innocent in a legal sense. Abu Zubaydah, did, what was involved in, things that the U.S. would obviously, frown upon, to put it in a way that,
unless he was doing it in Syria, in which case they'd pay his way. But anyway, go ahead.
But the point being that he was certainly, involved in things that it programs, operations that the U.S. would, later say that this was, this was terrorism. And, he certainly in his diaries makes clear that he wanted to, or at least fantasized about, attacks and plots against Israel, and slaughtering people. But again, there was no evidence. There was nothing there that showed that he was involved in any operation, any planning. He was not involved with Al Qaeda. And the only evidence that the U.S. really has against him is that he was almost like this, he was like a Rolodex. He was sort of, because of given his position at this camp, he knew people that went in and out of these camps, knew who they were. He obviously wrote their names down. What was really interesting is, while you have these, Mujahideen and jihadists that are using pseudonyms, Abu Zubaydah was actually, used his real name. I mean, Abu Zubaydah, just so people know, it's not a pseudonym. That's actually his last name. That's the family's last name. He was very proud to say, I'm going to use my real name. His name did pop up, because of the people that, went in and out of these camps, and because he was an expert forgerer, at one point that the U.S. believed, that the FBI believed that he was, involved in something. But to go back to what you asked, early on, they knew within, 5 to 6 months, Scott, that this is not the guy. And for, 11, 12, 13 years, the public was told that yes, he still remained this top official. And it wasn't until 2009 that the Justice Department quietly backed away from every assertion that the Bush administration made about Abu Zubaydah. In fact, they say, in this motion, because he has a habeas corpus case. He has a case that his attorneys filed in U.S. District Court in which—
Because he's at Guantanamo now, right?
He's at Guantanamo. He's one of the high value, detainees that's being held in Camp 7 over there.
And he's to be tried like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, or he's to be held indefinitely without a trial? Do you know which category he's in there?
That actually, is interesting. He was previously, deemed to be held, without a trial, although they've been, you know, trying to figure out if they can bring charges against him. The news that I broke in this story, in addition to, you know, providing some detail, about this declaration, which I should add, I need to add that this declaration was unsealed and it was released in response to a motion, or a motion to intervene in this case by an investigative reporter named Raymond Bonner. And Raymond Bonner, asked the judge presiding over the case to unseal many of the motions and various filings that have been held, that have been shrouded in secrecy for 7 years, more than 7 years, Scott. So that's why this filing was released and this declaration was released. But as I was saying, you know, the Justice Department quietly backed away from every claim the Bush administration made about Abu Zubaydah. And in October of 2009, the government admitted in a court filing that its understanding of Abu Zubaydah's alleged role in al-Qaeda's activities, quote, has evolved with further investigation, and that it no longer stands behind any of the Bush administration's assertions. For some reason, that, you know, that revelation, that admission has never fully been fleshed out and discussed. I mean, he continues to be held up as this, you know, as this top official. So next month, Scott, there is going to be a parole board hearing. You know, they've been having these various parole board type hearings at Guantanamo to determine who can stay or who should stay, who can be released. And those are, you know, they're taking a look at those so-called forever prisoners and reevaluating them. Well, Abu Zubaydah is actually getting a parole board hearing. Now, I don't think that he will ever be released. I don't think that you will see, you know, this parole board saying, well, he looks like he's rehabilitated, he can go. But he is getting a hearing. And part of that hearing will be available for reporters to observe. And it would be the first time, you know, in 14 years that he would be seen publicly. So as you can imagine, it will be closely watched.
Yeah. Well, I hope you can get back there for that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's that is a plan.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'll let you go now, dude. I know you got other great work to do, but I sure appreciate it.
Oh, thank you, Scott. As always, I really appreciate you giving some attention to this. It's you know, it's important, and there's going to continue to be more to be revealed.
Absolutely. Well, you always got an open platform here, sir.
Thank you, Scott. Take care.
You too, man. All right, y'all. That is the great Jason Leopold. This is how the CIA's first captive after 9/11 described his years of torture. Read it at news.vice.com. That's my show. Check out the archives, more than 4,000 interviews at scotthorton.org. Help support at scotthorton.org. Oh, and sign up for the podcast feed there. I forgot to say. Help support at scotthorton.org/donate and follow me on Twitter at scotthortonshow. Thanks. Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our status enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself, WallStreetWindow.com.